In Mark chapter 10, Jesus says, "For even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many."
Here we have Jesus introducing this concept of his death, that his death, among other things, involves a ransom. A ransom is a payment that is made in order to secure the release of a hostage or of a captive.
Jesus died to give his life as a ransom. That must mean that someone is in captivity. Today on Renewing Your Mind, Dr. R.C. Sproul explains that before our hearts are made new, we're the ones in bondage to sin. The idea of Jesus dying on the cross to appease the Father's wrath is not popular today, but Dr. Sproul will explain why it's essential to understand this truth so that we're better able to proclaim the gospel as good news.
When I was a senior in college, I was required to do a senior research paper in my field, which happened to be philosophy. And because I minored in American literature, I had the permission to do a dual department research thesis. And so I did my senior paper on the existential implications of Melville's Moby Dick. Because in my opinion, Moby Dick is the greatest novel ever written in the English language. I really believe it is the great American novel, and I've always been fascinated with Melville as a writer. And of course, as I was preparing for that particular exercise, I had to read other literary critics who gave their interpretation of the meaning of this great novel, Moby Dick. And one of the most famous analysts of Melville is of the opinion that the whale in the story symbolizes evil, and that Ahab's relentless pursuit of the whale is in fact a story of a man's relentless pursuit of evil. And I disagree as strenuously as I know how with that interpretation. There's no doubt in my mind that the whale is the symbol of God in this book. And the great chapter on the whiteness of the whale, I think, should remove all doubt about that. And Ahab's monomaniacal pursuit of the whale is a story of an evil person's reaction to God. There's no question about that. And Melville's off-the-cuff statement in a little note that he wrote to his friend and contemporary Nathaniel Hawthorne when he wrote Moby Dick said, "I have written an evil book." It was not because he was writing a book about evil. It was because of some of the things that he was involved in this pursuit. But a strange thing takes place in this story that is often overlooked. Ahab is so frantic and insistent on discovering the whereabouts of the whale that he charts every sighting in history of this albino whale. And he has set up the seas in a grid system, and he puts down a mark and a time and a date and a place for every time there has been a sighting of Moby Dick. This is the evil of men trying to so chart God that they can predict his every action and his every movement that Melville is speaking about. But Ahab is obsessed with finding the whale. And since he has not been able to find him in the earlier stages of the voyage, he tries to create greater incentive for the crew of the Pequod to be on the lookout for the albino whale. And so he goes to midships, and there on the main mast, he takes out a hammer and a spike and drives a spike through this magnificent gold doubloon that he nails to the central mast. And he says that this gold doubloon will be given to the first sailor that sights Moby Dick and cries out, "Thar she blows." Well, then there's kind of a digression in the novel where Melville looks inside the heads of the various members of the crew as they get filled with lust for this gold doubloon and contemplate how the reception of that reward would change their lives. And they have such radically different perspectives on what that money would buy for them. One man just sees so many cigars that he would be kept forever in cigars. Another man sees the way in which the struggle of his family will be relieved by receiving this reward. And they all have a different view of it. Until finally, the little cabin boy, whose name is Pip, and he's kind of demented, he's not all there, he's irrational, he looks at the coin and he starts dancing a jig on the shipboard, and he sings out, "I see, you see, we all see." And it's in this that Melville deals with the subjective approach to this objective reality. Now, you might wonder what in the world that has to do with the atonement of Christ. Well, I've mentioned already that the naked event of the cross in history is not immediately transparent to those who were eyewitnesses of it. And there have been multitudes of theories that have been spun out down through the ages of the meaning and the significance of the cross. And this is dangerous business, to speculate upon the significance of the cross of Christ. And what we want to do is be faithful to the biblical interpretation and the biblical understanding of the meaning of this event. But even then, our work is still difficult, because it is not as if the portrait of the cross in the New Testament is monochromatic. That is, it's not painted with a single color. But rather, there are different nuances to the cross that are mentioned in the Bible. There is the cross, as we've already seen, as an act of satisfaction of divine justice. There is the dimension of substitution that we've already considered. But there are other ideas that are mentioned in conjunction with the cross in the New Testament. For example, there is the idea of the cross as a ransom that is paid. There is also the idea of the cross as a cosmic victory. One theologian in the 20th century from Sweden wrote an entire book entitled Christus Victor, in which he tried to reduce the whole meaning of the cross to the victory that Christ has over the powers of darkness and over the power of evil. And certainly, it is true that the New Testament sees as part of the meaning of the cross in Christ's victory over Satan and over the forces of evil. We remember that the very first gospel that was ever preached was preached in the garden when Adam and Eve sinned, and God cursed the serpent and cursed man in his labor and so on. He also gave us what is called the Proto-Evangelion, the first gospel that was ever preached, when he made the prophecy that the head of the serpent would be crushed by the seed of the woman, but in that process, the heel of the seed of the woman would be bruised. The New Testament would interpret that to be fulfilled in Christ's death, where on the cross, Christ crushes the head of Satan, but in the process suffers pain himself. His wound is not ultimately mortal. It is a bruising of his heel. Yes, he suffers death, but he is raised from that grave through the power of the resurrection. But the point is that the crushing defeat of Satan is not without pain. It is not without injury. It is not without a price that the Messiah must pay. And the New Testament uses the language of victory again and again with respect to the cross, that Christ in this victory leads captivity captive, and he goes into the heavenly places in triumph where he has defeated the powers of darkness. So we have all these different strands that are woven together into the tapestry of the cross in the biblical portrait. But what I want us to understand is that it is a multifaceted event. And we would be remiss if we were to try to reduce the entire significance of the death of Christ to merely one of these aspects, such as ransom or victory or even substitution or satisfaction. And what I'm saying is that the cross is not just one of these, but nor is it none of these. It is all of these. All of these elements are part of the full fabric of this redemptive work. And there are others as well, which we shall look at. But for now, I want to focus our attention on this idea of ransom. If we turn our attention for a moment to the Gospel according to St. Mark, to the 10th chapter, where a discussion takes place that is somewhat problematic, beginning at verse 35. We read this text, "Then James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came to him," that is to Jesus, "saying, 'Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask.'" You know, sometimes you wonder how often a leader becomes irritated with his followers, a pastor with his congregation, a coach with his players, and so on. Here we have one of those episodes in the New Testament where Jesus truly gets annoyed with some of his closest friends and disciples. James and John, the sons of thunder, the sons of Zebedee, are two of his earliest disciples, and obviously two of his closest disciples that made up part of the so-called inner circle, even of the 12. They came to Jesus saying, "We want you to do for us whatever we ask." Isn't that typical? And Jesus said to them, "Well, what is it that you want me to do for you?" And they said to him, "Grant us that we may sit, one on your right hand and the other on your left, in your glory." Anybody who's ever been the president of an organization knows the right-hand, left-hand syndrome, that people who are close to the person in authority or the person in power are constantly jockeying for position, and everybody wants to sit close to the king or to the president or to the captain or to the coach. Everybody wants that elevated status. And I've talked to lots of people who have been in the role of president in other organizations, and I say to them, I say, "Have you noticed that people in your organization relate to you in a way that's different from how they relate to each other?" You know, it's the bane of leadership, where people treat you in a kind of deferential manner, and they can be at each other's throats and show a completely different personality when they're dealing with each other, because they're in competition. And that's what Jesus had to deal with his own disciples. Here, James and John, these brothers, they come up and they say, "Jesus, we would like to make sure that when you come into your kingdom, that Peter and Nathaniel get to sit on your right hand and on your left hand." No, that's not what they ask. They want to sit on the right hand and on the left hand of Jesus. And I'm sure they were ready to kill each other as to who was going to get the right side and who was going to get the left side. But Jesus said, "You don't know what you are asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I drink and be baptized with the baptism that I am baptized with?" Now, Jesus has calmly rebuked them and said, "You guys don't know what you're asking." And he doesn't ask them the question, "Are you able?" He said, "You're not able," really, is what he's saying. "You're not able." He asks it as a question, but what I mean is that it's a rhetorical question, that the answer is obviously no. "Are you able to drink the cup that I drink? Be baptized with the baptism that I'm baptized with?" But they don't get it. They don't see it as a rhetorical question. And they said to him, "We are able." I mean, this reveals how profoundly two of Jesus' closest disciples did not get it. They didn't understand the mission that was the burden of Christ. All they were looking at was the glory that went with the office of being Messiah. They didn't understand anything of the shame yet or the humiliation that attended that office. They didn't understand that for Christ to be elevated to the right hand of God, to ascend into heaven to his place of glory, he first had to suffer and die. That was the baptism that was given to him. That was the cup that the Father had set before him at his table. That was the cup over which Jesus would wrestle at Gethsemane. But they said, "We're able." They proved what Jesus had just said a moment before, that they didn't understand.
And so Jesus said to them, "You will indeed drink the cup that I drink, and with the baptism I am baptized with, you will be baptized. But to sit on my right hand and on my left is not mine to give, but it is for those for whom it is prepared." And when the 10 heard it, they began to be greatly displeased with James and John.
Of course they would be.
But Jesus called them to himself and said to them, "You know that those who are considered rulers over the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them. Yet it shall not be among you, but whosoever desires to become great among you shall be your servant, and whoever of you desires to be first shall be slave of all. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life a ransom for many." Now, in this episode where Jesus takes this opportunity to rebuke his disciples who are intoxicated with ambition, to explain to them what ministry is all about, that ministry is a call to service, and that the first qualification for ministry is a willingness to participate in the humiliation of Christ. He takes this occasion to instruct them on that, and then he comes to this startling conclusion. You have to understand that even the Son of Man, and he's referring to himself here, even the one who has descended from heaven, from the glory of the presence of the Father, that even the Son of Man has come not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. Here we have Jesus introducing this concept of his death, that his death, among other things, involves a ransom. Well, what is a ransom? A ransom is a payment that is made in order to secure the release of a hostage or of a captive. We associate ransoms with kidnappings. When somebody is kidnapped, the first thing that the police are looking for is what? A ransom note. And a ransom note is that note that demands a payment in exchange for the release of the person kidnapped or the person who is held hostage. Now, we remember that when Jesus spoke at Nazareth and the text of Isaiah 61 was read that predicted the ministry of the Messiah, among which tasks the Messiah would perform were included that he would release the captives. He would set at liberty those who were held captive. Well, how does Jesus release the captives? He does it by paying a ransom. Now, the ransom theory of the atonement has a long history in Christian theology, but it is articulated in two different and often conflicting ways. One theory of ransom is that Jesus paid a ransom to Satan, because Satan was the kidnapper. Satan was the one who holds people hostage, because the Bible does teach that fallen man is in bondage to sin and is a slave, as it were, of Satan, and so that one must be set free from Satan. And so the idea of a ransom that is paid to the devil in order to satisfy his demands, in order to allow people to go free, has had a long history in Christianity. I disagree with it, and I favor the other ransom theory, namely that there is a ransom that is paid, but the ransom is paid not to Satan, but to God. Because God is the one who must be satisfied. He is the one to whom the debt is owed, and he is the one to whom the debt is paid. Jesus doesn't negotiate with Satan for our salvation. Jesus pays the demands of the Father, which then, by the Father's satisfaction, the Father commands the release of the hostages, and Satan's power is broken. And indeed, Satan would hold us hostage, and Satan does exercise a tyranny over us. I don't mean to suggest that he doesn't, but I don't want us to see that Satan is the one who acquiesces to the victory of Christ by receiving this payment. No. There's no negotiation with the hostage holder here. All that happens to the hostage holder is that his head is crushed, and it is the Father who liberates us once the Son pays him the ransom. How that works out, we'll look in greater detail in our next session.
The sacrificial death of Christ on the cross on our behalf, that's good news, and we can see why it brings us such peace. We're glad you're with us on this Tuesday here on Renewing Your Mind. We're making our way through Dr. R.C. Sproul's series, The Atonement of Jesus. Believe it or not, there are critics of this doctrine today, so we as believers need to be equipped to answer their objections. We're airing 5 of the 10 messages from this series this week, but we will send you all 10 lectures on 4 audio CDs when you contact us today with your gift of any amount. We'll also include Dr. Sproul's book, The Truth of the Cross, an excellent companion to this audio series. Request both of these resources with your gift of any amount. You can do that securely online at renewingyourmind.org or by calling us at 800-435-4343. Perhaps you've heard some of the objections that Dr. Sproul has addressed in this series from family members or friends. You may want to consider giving one or both of these resources to them to begin a conversation. So again, request The Atonement of Jesus, a series by Dr. R.C. Sproul. It's on 4 CDs, and the hardbound book, The Truth of the Cross. They're yours for your gift of any amount when you call us at 800-435-4343. Or when you go online to renewingyourmind.org. Before we go today, here's a final thought from Dr. Sproul.
In 1995, the nation held its breath when 2 Americans wandered out of limits in Iraq and were taken captive and held hostage by the government. And we remember that their wives were given the opportunity to visit them in captivity. And then after they returned to America, they appeared on national television, and they wept and they pled for the government of the United States to do something to free their husbands from their incarceration in this foreign land. The idea of taking hostages has become an international game that has become scandalous to all nations. And when this takes place, there is always the moral dilemma. If we pay a ransom to those who hold prisoners hostage, then we are simply encouraging other evildoers to continue that practice. And so it is the policy of the government not to pay ransoms, but to seek other means to secure the release of those arrested on foreign soil or those who are held hostage. But God does not rule out the paying of a ransom if it means the rescue of his people from certain destruction. And Christ comes and pays such a ransom in order to secure the release of and make certain the future well-being of his people who are held captive to sin and held hostage. Christ gives this ransom and pays it voluntarily, just as a parent would willingly pay whatever he could to save the life of a child who has been kidnapped. So our Savior pays the ransom that is necessary to redeem our souls.
Well, Dr. Sproul continues this series Wednesday on Renewing Your Mind, helping us understand the wonder of the atonement, that Jesus paid the moral debt for sinners, and the Father accepted that payment. Join us Wednesday for Renewing Your Mind.